Geekville Radio.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Hello, once again, ladies and gentlemen, geeks and geekesses. This is Seth, a.k.a. Xandrax, the mayor of Geekville, and the host of Geekville Radio, coming at you with a exciting but special show, because in case you didn't know, there was this little independent series that came back over the weekend called The Mandalorian, and we're going to talk the season premiere of The Mandalorian, and then in the second half of the show, we're going to pay tribute to the late, great Sean Connery. And fortunately, I don't have to do it alone. Joining me once again from the nice, soft, padded cell in South Kakalaki, Crazy Train Jonathan Bullock.
All aboard, ladies and gentlemen. As we record this on November 4th, I think it was just something me and Seth said. We had to step out of all the election insanity and just get our minds on some geekery to get back to normal. So that's why we're recording now. And Mando dropping was nice. We just got done with our Halloween celebration for the entire month of October. And that's kind of a nice addition this year to my Halloween weekend. I kind of enjoyed that.
I thought it was a heck of a season premiere. It had just about everything one could want. And before we go any further, though, let me wave the flag.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler hull has been breached. Spoiler hull has been breached.
We're going to get pretty heavy with these spoilers. So if you haven't seen the episode and don't want anything spoiled, you can stop now. Go watch the season premiere of The Mandalorian, then come back. We will wait right here. But if you have seen the episode or you don't mind being spoiled and you want to know what happens, well, this is definitely the show for you. It seems like it picked up maybe a little bit of time after the first season. I don't think it was immediately after, because obviously they'd already changed planets. But the setup, of course, is that Mando is supposed to find Baby Yoda's home planet or take him back to his people. And that really seems to be the biggest part of it. And of course, Kara and Greef Karga were essentially going to restart their Bounty Hunters Guild, right? Do I have that part right?
That seems like right to me. And one of the biggest giveaways to me that this was a little bit of a time jump is that we did see throughout this episode, Baby Yoda had definitely developed a little bit more verbal skills, like all younger sentient beings do. The older they get, the more they learn to talk, basically. I'm sure you noticed that as well.
Yeah, he seemed to do more than just kind of coo and purr.
Right. And as a father myself, that's just the way it works. They make noises until they're about one or two, and then they start talking.
I remember when I was texting you about this, because I saw the episode before you did, early on in the beginning, when Mando goes into that underground fight club and they have the Gamorreans battling each other with axes, I told you there was going to be a spot, as in a wrestling spot, that you would like. Because I cracked up when I saw it, where it's like all hell breaks loose with Mando and the goons, so to speak. And then there's this Gamorrean that won the fight. Well, he won because the crime boss shot the other guy.
Right.
But he goes for a plancha or a dive, and not only does he miss, he crashes through a table. I busted a gut when that happened.
Yeah, the heel goes for a move over the top to the outside of the baby face move. And as as the late, great Dusty Rhodes would say when he would call spots like that in wrestling, They went off to high dive and the pool was dry. Right. How many times have we seen that? Or Tony Schiavone with his high risk, high reward. That's what they call it, high risk, high reward. You know?
Right. But the major points that I got out of this episode, and obviously you're free to add your own, probably the biggest news is we got the confirmation of the whereabouts of Boba Fett. Cobb Vanth, who was played by Timothy Oliphant, he had procured Boba Fett's armor, and there was a scene in the book Aftermath. It was a little more detailed than that, because I think he had like rescued a baby Hutt or something like that, and that he got the armor as a reward. It's been a couple of years since I read the book, so I am probably a little foggy on that. But it was more or less what he had said in the episode. But there was a little more detail to that, which quite frankly they didn't need to show for a quick montage.
Sure.
So I do have to ask, what did you think of Timothy Oliphant in the Boba Fett armor?
Well, I'm a big fan of Timothy's. I've talked about it here on the podcast a lot. I've said this before too, especially in light of his roles on Deadwood and Justified. He's kind of the go-to guy nowadays for Westerns, at least in that age bracket. It was Sam Elliott's still with us. So, and so right. Is Kurt Russell, but he's younger than both of them. So I kind of knew he was going to work when I heard what character he was going to be. You did not tell me going into it that he had Boba Fett's armor, but the moment I saw him, one, I knew it was Timothy Olyphant. He's a tall, skinny guy who has that Clint Eastwood, John Wayne kind of saunter to him.
Yeah,
that
he's
we
cowboy.
Expect in our Yeah, exactly. What we expect in our Western stars. So I knew even underneath the armor that it was him before he even started talking. And then that removed all doubt. And I thought, wait a second, that's Boba Fett's arm. And we're on Tatooine. This is going to get interesting. And they kind of laid the story out from there, how I had almost instantaneously worked it out in my mind, how he got the armor without any knowledge of the book you're talking about. I also, and I think I had texted you this while I was watching it, that, yeah, now I can see why there were these early rumors floating around that he was going to be Boba Fett. It's not hard to kind of figure it out in today's day and age with leaked footage and the internet. Somebody obviously was on set or a photo leaked of Olyphant in Boba Fett's armor. And then that got out and then all the fanboys went to speculate. Does it sound about right to you?
Yeah, I think so. And because I remember the most circulated picture that I think piqued the interest of the circle of geekery that I am in was the speeders. You saw the two speeders riding side by side, but you only saw a little bit of the backs of the riders. And one of them, it looked like Boba Fett's backpack, just without the rocket attached. Exactly. Yeah.
Am I wrong at thinking that seeing all the two speeders was also a tip of the hat to Easy Rider?
Possibly. I was expecting, like, you know, Man with No Name theme to play or something like that when they were riding.
Well, I mean, I think Easy Rider was a modern one in many ways. They just replaced the horses with motorcycles. Mm-hmm. He's obviously definitely a very counterculture movie when it came out, but I kind of saw the Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper there. That's just me. So it was obvious that the speeder that Mando got was an old refitted Imperial speeder that, like, we saw in Return of the Jedi on Endor.
Right.
And you had pointed out to me, and I thought the same thing, that the one that Cobb Vance had looked like a modified thruster or whatever jet propulsion from a pod racer.
Right. It actually looked very similar to the type of engine that Anakin Skywalker had on his pod. And
once again, we're on Tatooine, so this all is making sense.
Exactly. And I heard some fan speculation. I don't really read too much into fan speculation because so much of it, I think, comes down to what the fan doing the speculating. It's like what I want to see, and everything else is silly. So I don't like getting into that. But the fan theory that I think holds up is maybe rather than it actually being something from Anakin Skywalker's speeder. Well, let's face it. Anakin Skywalker won that race practically after being lapped. Somebody's going to look into, okay, what kind of tech is in this engine?
Right.
And of course, Anakin left shortly after that. So it's very possible somebody got a hold of that engine, marketed it, and then it became more widely available.
Or it could be the actual speeder itself, because we know Watto laid claim to that speeder afterwards. That was part of the whole bet, was that Qui-Gon had to ride a pod racer to even enter Anakin in. And we all know Watto is not afraid to make a buck. So if the right offer came along, don't you think he'd take it?
Yeah, so the engine does.
Well, plus, also, let's be honest, he's kind of a wussy. It wouldn't be hard to intimidate it out of him either. Let's be honest.
Right.
And that's the first time I had ever heard of, was it most, they're calling it Pospa or Pespa or whatever, the game of the P, the little
Mos,
the town there.
Mos Pelgo.
Pelgo. I never heard of that. Was that in the book?
I believe it had been mentioned. I think that was in that same book that Cobb Vance was in. But like I said, it's been a while. And they did explain kind of how nobody really heard of it, because literally the same day the Death Star 2 blew up, then bandits basically took over the place, probably because they knew that, okay, well, there's no Empire that's going to come to their rescue.
Well, and I liked that scene because, once again, very similar to George in his original drafts for what the Star Wars universe is. He's talked about how he borrowed from our real culture and history here on Earth. How many times have we seen tyrannical government get overthrown, and as soon as it falls, the warlords come in and it becomes little fiefdoms?
Exactly, yes. Which is kind of what happened in the Expanded Universe books around the time of the Thrawn books. You know, they explained it. The Emperor got overthrown, and then all of a sudden all these warlords want their piece of the cookie jar.
Sure, sure. I could spend the next 30 minutes going listing actual historical examples of that here on this, here on Earth in our own history. So not like it's a big stretch there.
The other big reveal, other than Boba Fett's armor, they dangled the carrot. I know there's some people speculating otherwise, but I don't think there's any doubt. The last scene you saw as the heroes zip off in their speeder, you see that black cloaked figure watching them, and he turns around and it is Temuera Morrison. I don't think there's any doubt. That's Boba Fett.
That's Boba Fett. Am I wrong in feeling when the Tusken Raiders explain to Mando and Vance that the reason the Kray dragon is in a Sarlacc's hole is because it ate the Sarlacc, that this, I'm already believing this is probably the same Sarlacc that Jabba took people to. So this is the same Sarlacc we saw in the first act of Return of the Jedi. So you're thinking the same thing too.
I thought the same thing, if anything, just for simplicity's sake. It makes the story more simple to follow. I do believe that there's probably more than one, if not many, Sarlacc pits, because in that discussion, when they talk about abandoned Sarlacc pit, and Vance said something like, I've never heard of abandoned Sarlacc pit, they're speaking and, not the.
Like there's more than one.
Exactly. Because I don't recall seeing all those mountains around in Return of the Jedi, but you could argue that it's just the placement of where the quote-unquote cameras would have been in the setting.
Part of my reinforcement of that is when Mando is explaining to Vance why he respects the Tusken Raiders, he talks about the Dune Sea is a brutal place, and they've survived here for 1,000 years. We know from Return of the Jedi, we don't know where, we just know that Jabba took his barge out with Han and, you know, Luke to kill them to the Dune Sea. So I've always kind of seen the Dune Sea, and I don't have a map of Tatooine. I figure it's what it is. It's a big, wide open area full of just sand dunes. But think about how big our own Pacific or Atlantic oceans are.
And of course, there's the whole thing once we get into the Krayt Dragon about how they travel below the surface. So it's like you got this creature's traveling below the surface in sand. It's called the Dune Sea. Oh, that's the we got a Dune and Tremors tribute going on here.
Yeah. Exactly. I was thinking the same thing. Because remember, Tremors is supposed to be set, I think, in Arizona, New Mexico. So our own desert areas of our country. So there you go. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing.
I was thinking Dune more than Tremors, but it's kind of hard to not think Tremors when you see creatures just climbing up out of the sand in random places.
And our talking about it on our last Examine the Dead a couple weeks ago was fresh on your memory, so it wasn't hard to draw that conclusion. My first thought was, well, did the Kray Dragon killed Boba Fett and either puked out or pooped out the armor, and then the Jawas came along and got it, because that's what they do, right?
Right.
But then, as the battle went on, and we saw that the Kray Dragon spitting up that Ikkers, I think was what the Custom Raiders called it, it seemed to have an acidic quality, because he was definitely using it in an offensive manner as a weapon, you know?
Right.
And I'm going, well, maybe, I don't know. I didn't know. I was very shocked by the Boba Fett at the end, but it did explain how his armor survived.
Speaking of the Tusken Raiders, I think this is really the first time we ever saw like a human quality to them. They've always been depicted as being savages, and obviously the scene with Anakin's mother, how they held her captive, and I'm assuming they probably did nasty things to her, but this is a time where we actually see them negotiate and make a deal, and Mando even says they will keep their end of the bargain, or they will keep their word. So I thought it was very interesting to see these characters almost in a sympathetic light.
Yeah, everything we've had up till then, even if going back to the first appearance, if Obi-Wan didn't show up, I get a feeling they kill Luke, don't you?
At the very least, they would have taken all his stuff.
Right. So they are raiders. He even says that. They are raiders. And raider, they're pirates. Well,
they raid.
The Vikings were raiders. So they didn't just come by that name by chance. They earned that name. So I think it was the first time. It's definitely the first time we've seen them communicate in any way, right?
Right.
With another race, I should say.
I think they're seen briefly in the first season, the Gunslinger episode, which had Ming-Na Wen in them, because they sneak up on Mando and whoever the young Gunslinger was. But Mando, like, knew it was coming and, like, talked their way out rather than fighting
them.
So it does show that Mando has... It's like he didn't just learn how to deal with Tuskens. He already knew, even back in the first season.
Right, right. And obviously, we definitely saw it in this episode. He knows how to speak their language. Now, my understanding has always been that isn't their actual face. That's just like a head wrap and like some kind of breathing apparatus or mask that the Tusken Raiders wear, correct?
Right. It is a helmet and a mask.
Okay.
Because there is the speculation that Boba Fett wasn't just wandering around in the desert. Because I think what they have definitely implied was, going back to that Gunslinger episode, the mysterious figure that caught up to Ming-Na Wen's character after she'd been killed. I remember the speculation was that it was Boba Fett, and it looks like that very well may have been, because there's still the black cloaks that he was wearing.
Right.
But I like the idea of maybe he's just not walking around in black in the desert. If you look closely, some of the stuff he's carrying and some of the stuff he's wearing was similar to what the Tusken Raiders were wearing. So it's very possible Boba Fett was posing as one of them for the last few years, basically just to survive.
Yeah, that long gun that looked almost like an old Kentucky rifle flintlock. The first time we see one of those is actually in New Hope. But I also then again saw the villagers that sided with them from Mos Peglo or whatever the name of the place was, the Cobb Vanth town. They were wielding them too, which makes me wonder, is that just a weapon that is common on Tatooine or not? I don't know.
It's possible, because you do see them in Phantom Menace during the pod race where they're mm-hmm. shooting at some of the pod racers with them.
Right. And I think Luke even had one, didn't he? He kept on the side of his sand speeder in New Hope. So that asks the question, is it a weapon that is common in Tatooine because the Tusken Raiders have it, or is it one that they just came there and they adapted as well as everybody else? That's the big question.
Just my assumption is it's probably just a fairly common weapon, and it's just something that Raiders had acquired over time. That's just my hunch.
Sure, and like most nomadic tribes, like Tusken Raiders, the Tusken Raiders being a nomadic group, just like most nomadic groups, I would not be surprised if they take a weapon that is common and modify it to their uses. We have many examples of that just here in the United States with like Native American tribes. Like, I know one of the bigger ones for the tribes, the Iroquois tribes in and around New York, once firearms were introduced by Europeans, not only did they use the firearms as were used by the Europeans, they would take the stocks and use them to make their war clubs. So I that's kind of how I've always said it was a weapon that somehow wound up in pretty high numbers on Tatooine, and the Tusken Raiders just kind of took it as their own and probably adapted it to their own needs. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are we both thinking the same thing here, though, that this is going to be a major story arc the rest of the season? Is Boba Fett, how did he survive, and maybe even like the hatred that the Mandalorian Creed has against the Fetts themselves?
I don't think they would dangle that carrot without following through on it. I think this episode planted a lot of seeds that are going to be sowed throughout the season. I forget if it's 8 episodes like last year or if it's going to be 10, but this is definitely going to be an episode we're going to look back on in another month or two and say, ah, okay, that's what that meant. I'm fully confident of that.
Now, I do think that every episode now, especially with the popularity of Baby Yoda, is going to have that one, oh, that was cute. We got that one in this one early on when Baby Yoda realizes everything's going to go south when Mando first meets up with that crime boss at the Gamorrean fight. And he closes up his little bassinet. That was hilarious.
Like, oh, crap.
Because, I mean, we have seen, it's been established, the wrist rockets that Mando has. He saw him reaching for him. He's like, okay, time for me to hide.
like he knew it was coming, because he'd seen it more than once before.
Right. And they did not have, in this episode, Baby Yoda use any of his force powers. How much do you speculate we're going to get to see that? Are we going to see any new powers, or are they going to kind of stray away from that, or what, this season?
I would imagine we're going to see something new, or at least maybe some advancement. Because really, he didn't use his powers that much in the first season. It was really only 2 or 3 times. Because there was that time he lifted the mud rhino or whatever they called it.
Right. The time he did the force heal.
Yeah. He healed Mando. And then I think towards the end he did some. Because remember, Grief had that line of, come on, baby, do the magic hand thing.
Yeah. Well, he stopped the flame trooper. You remember? He stopped the flame trooper. And then, Grief's like, do it. And he just waves at him. That was the adorable moment for that episode, by the way.
Right. And now, speaking of Gore Koresh, did you notice who the voice was for that?
I'm assuming it was Jal Leguizamo, because I saw him in the credits.
Right. I don't think he was in the suit at all. I think it was just his voice. Because I would imagine somebody like him, you probably wouldn't need to put under a mask, because he's a good enough actor.
Right.
He could play the part.
And I've spoken at length about my fandom of his and his work. I think he's great. It just reinforces there are a lot of A and B list actors in Hollywood that are around our age that grew up fans of this franchise that are looking for any opportunity to get involved in it anyway, just like the Daniel Craig uncredited cameo from right. Force Awakens. It just, mm-hmm. it is what it is.
Right. Because if I recall correctly, the bartender was like a Weequay or something like that. That was
right.
another actor from Deadwood. So it was like a little Deadwood reunion when Timothy Olyphant walked in.
There's a lot of those. Deadwood had such a big cast. I know you never watched the show. I did.
Right.
It had such a big cast with people coming in and out. And then you throw in Justified and you throw in Longmire. There was a lot of crossover on those three shows. And I think all three are Westerns. And so you're looking for an actor who has a certain look and a certain way to deliver their lines. And you have a budget. These are working character TV actors. It just makes sense. They're going to have crossover, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because I remember the blue fish-like character that Mando captured in the first episode of the first season.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a Saturday Night Live guy. And then the guy that drove the speeder was also another comedian. Just like, and they'd worked together before.
Right, and I can't remember her name because she's now a recurring character. The lady that runs the little port he always lands in when he goes to Tatooine, she's a comedian. I can't think of her name right now.
Amy Sedaris, she was playing Pele Motto.
Right.
And I think she does a great job in the show.
I think she's wonderful.
You totally believe that this is a little bit of an eccentric but very intelligent mechanic.
She's out there, and she's. I joke with people, she's this show's Cooter.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Because Cooter wasn't dumb, and the Dukes considered him one of their own, but he was a bit eccentric, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I would not be surprised at all if there was a scene in Dukes of Hazzard where Cooter would like be talking to the truck that he's working on.
Yes. But we didn't get to see until many seasons later. He actually got some character development. We found out he had a daughter he didn't even know about when he was much younger, and she was older now, and they reconnected. So that also always told me, and Cooter's a little older than Bo and Luke, but right. I digress. We've already done a whole nostalgia trip on Dukes of Hazzard.
And also, I can't mention the episode, especially since we just started talking about Pele. We got the R5-D4 cameo, and I've always been a big R5-D4 fan.
You like that reddish orange with the more squared off top than the round top?
Yeah. And apparently somebody fixed his motivator.
Well, I know I like the little, I don't know what you call those droids, but we first see them in Watto's shop in Phantom Menace that she uses to fix her stuff. They're used for comedic effect well, too.
Right. I think they're just called pit droids.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that hey, little Annie, hit him on the head.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
Or like building up for the speeder racers when one of them was making a pit stop and one of the pit droids walks past the engine and then gets sucked through it and the engine explodes.
Right.
And then he comes out on the other side like, whoa, that felt good.
Yeah. Isn't that like Sebulba's whole pit crew's made up of them?
Something like, yeah.
Yeah, so I know I'm going to catch a lot of flack. We all know those are the kind of characters that George created to fill out his universe, but also seeing dollar signs because of marketing possibility. I think, though, most people agree, those things are cute and much less annoying than Jar Jar Binks. And I'm not the major Jar Jar Binks hater everybody else is, so there you go. What does that say?
I've always liked Jar Jar because I could relate to him. I can relate to being the village idiot.
Oh, no offense, not me, but that's okay. I don't think Jar Jar. I don't think Jar Jar is as bad, the worst character they ever created. Contrary to, I know what popular opinion is.
Right. He was there for the kids. He wasn't there for the adults.
Right. It's like a friend of mine points out all the time, who's a big wrestling fan. He doesn't hate John Cena because he realizes John Cena wasn't booked for him. He was booked for the kids.
Exactly. Yeah.
You have to look at Star Wars a little bit the same way sometimes, and. Like, okay, you want to hate the Ewoks, but they're so damn cute. How can you, even though they were created for the kids?
Exactly, yeah.
And if you tell me you didn't get a tear in the corner of your eye when that one died on the Battle of Endor, I'm telling you, you're lying. Because that was an emotional scene.
Right.
It's like, oh, but damn.
Yeah, the two biggest emotions with the Ewoks was, that one that died and then that baby Ewok that was in a little nest.
Oh, the entire theater goes at the exact same time and you just, when it pops out. The first time I saw that in the theater. Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're tugging at your heartstrings, but guess what? That's what entertainment people do. That's why it's called entertainment.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, it's what space opera or even great westerns do. You have the cool moments, you have the dramatic moments, and then you have the moments where you just kind of catch your breath a little bit and just go, oh,
funny moments, you know, funny yeah. moments, maybe even scary moments. I think that has become a staple of the summer blockbuster popcorn movie. I'll always say I think Jaws was the first of that type, and Jaws had all those things. And the Star Wars movies definitely have all those. So why do you think that this half hour per episode series based in that universe is going to be any different? It's not.
So where do you think they go from here? We know Mando's got Boba Fett's armor. He's presumably leaving Tatooine, and Boba Fett's still there. It would seem like if we're going to continue Boba Fett's story, he's going to have to get off of Tatooine somehow, or Mando's going to have to come back to Tatooine. Because I think payoff to this is going to be Boba Fett getting his armor back. I don't think they're going to dangle that carrot without following through with it.
Well, a question for you who knows more about the expanded stuff than I do. Do we know whether or not Slave 1 has been destroyed?
I would be surprised if it's still around, because that might have been one of the... If I were Boba Fett, that'd be one of the first things I'd seek out. And it's been years, and I don't think a ship is just going to sit in a starport for 5 years without somebody...
Why not? The Millennium Falcon did.
Well, that's because Unger Platt owned it.
That's true. And that character was portrayed by Simon Pegg, yet another example of an A-list actor.
Right, exactly.
Just wanting to get involved in the franchise. But just nostalgia's sake, for fanboy's sake, I wouldn't mind or be surprised if he winds up with at least a variant of that type of ship again.
The flying clothes iron?
Yeah, that's why I think it looks like an old iron is what I've always thought it looked like. But I think it's a cool ship, personally. I always have. When I had all the toys as a kid, that was one of my favorite of the ships I owned.
I liked the way it looked when it flew. It looked weird, but it also looked cool. Kind of like the B-Wing.
Right, exactly. My holy grail when ships as a kid was the Millennium Falcon. You took the back off and it had the little chess board on it, and you pop up in the cockpit and two in there, and it had the gun that you could turn, and it made the sound, the little clicky sound, the turrets. But yeah, Slave One was one of my favorites. I wouldn't mind seeing it again, but you're right. He needs to find a ship and get off. I don't know if that's going to be the main storyline for this season, but I definitely, like you said, you don't dangle that carrot without paying it off. I don't think it's going to be an every episode thing either. And if it does, if we see this Friday when the next episode drops, if we see Boba Fett right again, I think this is a storyline expect to be concluded before the end of the series. But if you don't see him, expect it to be one that he'll pop in every third or fourth episode, and then we'll have some kind of resolution towards the end of the season. I think you've got Giancarlo Esposito's character.
Moff Gideon.
Moff Gideon with the black lightsaber. Obviously, that has to have some progression. Whether it's resolved or not, I don't know. But right, that storyline obviously is the main storyline.
Right, because as fans of the animated series that have been over the years have known, that is a Mandalorian weapon. It actually belonged to the royal family of Mandalorian. The last person that had possession of it was Bo-Katan, who in the Clone Wars and in Rebels was voiced by Katie Sackhoff. And it's been said that Katie Sackhoff herself is going to appear in the show. So I think she's going to come and collect on that, because by rights, that darksaber belongs to her.
And as far as the Baby Yoda goes, this is an excellent opportunity. Now, whether they follow through on it or not, I think they will. But we've talked about before that whatever race Yoda is, there's so little known about it. It is definitely one of the great unanswered questions of the Star Wars mythos. This is an opportunity to maybe give us some of that.
Right.
As Mando attempts to reunite. And it also begs me wonder, there's been this speculation that there's only one or two types of that race alive at any one time, like one female, one male. So is he even going to be successful in finding his race? Or are we going to find a whole planet full of Yodas? That'd be kind of cool.
Especially if they're not as old as Yoda. If we do find kind of young and in their prime Yoda species, are they still going to talk sideways like Yoda did?
Right. I've also kind of had this own theory for a while that maybe there is a planet of these type. Think Vandal Savage, if you understand that character from DC. Remember, he's an Athandarall who was exposed to a meteorite that hit Earth, and that caused him it gave him immortality and super intelligence. So he was well far beyond the primitive people that looked like him, other Nathandarals. It's possible that there's a whole planet full of very primitive looking creatures that are Yoda, and Yoda, for whatever reason, was just way advanced beyond the rest of his race. And maybe Baby Yoda is too. I don't know.
It is possible. We know that they age slowly because Baby Yoda is supposed to be 50 years old. So it seems like they age.
Yeah, we know Yoda was what, over 900 years old when he died?
Right. So it seems like they age 1 year for every 10 human years, it seems.
Or probably even more than that. If Baby Yoda is supposed to be 50, I'm thinking like 1 year of our life is like 15, 20 to them. Because I don't think Baby Yoda is older in human years, 2-3 years old.
Right, because he's not really talking. He can walk.
Barely. He's a toddler. He's right. Literally a toddler, you know?
Yeah, because you can have a conversation with a five-year-old. It might not be very in-depth, but you can have a conversation.
Right. Sure. Not going to be any great, deep, meaningful breakdown of Kant or Plato or anything, but you can have a conversation with him.
Another question that I have that I think is another carrot that was dangled. I think we're going to see Mando's old buddies again, that they did that heist or that raid on that prison ship, you know, with.
Oh, yeah, because he didn't kill him. He didn't right. kill him. But they did kill the one Twi'lek and the Mark Boone Jr. character, the leader of the group, the one that set it up. Because remember, he hid the tracker on him. And we know that the X-Wing fighters showed up and destroyed his ship. But the other members, the Bill Burr, Clancy Brown characters, they're still on that prison barge, aren't they?
Last we saw, he put them all in the same cell, it looked like. So
right.
It'll be interesting to see how they get out, if they're going to get found or if they somehow bust themselves out. I would imagine they might be able to bust themselves out. Either way, I think we're going to see them again.
It did seem like that entire episode of last season was just playing on that trope. There have been a lot of Westerns that are about jailbreaks or prison heists. That was kind of that episode for that season.
Exactly. Yeah. Is there anything else you noticed or what you think we might see in the season?
I do think he's going to come back to Tatooine because I'm a big Olyphant fan. I'd like to see the Cobb Vanth character, right?
I think we will, yeah.
But if we don't, I won't be surprised either because we've had a lot of, like we only saw Bill Burr once last season. Ming-Wah's character got killed off right away. So they have had other big actors come in and then not brought him back. We'll see. I wouldn't even be shocked if the quote-unquote final stand is back on Tatooine, the series finale, or season finale, I should say. But we'll see. We do know from the trailer we're going to see an ice planet of some sort, which, you know, lends you to believe Hoth. We know because of the boat scene there's going to be a water planet. My speculation, maybe Kamino, but Kamino seemed more like really, really rough seas, more like a lake to me, like a big lake, like the Great Lakes like you have up where you are, but still more of a calmer water. And there was also a scene that looked very much like Endor. So I think there, obviously we know from the trailer we're going to see several other worlds. I think we are in agreement on that.
Yeah. And Star Wars kind of needs that. It's not quite Star Wars unless you have more than one planet to travel to.
Right. And that's always been, I think, just one of the things that has appealed to the hardcores like you and me is their ability in every movie to show us three or four very diverse and different climates and topographies because through the use of different planets. Kishyak's very different than Dagobah. Dagobah is very different than Hoth. Hoth's very different than Tatooine. Tatooine's very different than Yavin, whatever.
It would be interesting, I think you'd said it, that if that water planet is Kamino, where the clones come from. I'm not saying it will, but I think this is the first time we'll see Star Wars with, like, boats. I don't recall any epic boat scene in a Star Wars movie.
Well, there was the submersible that they used from the Gungans in Phantom Menace, but that other than that, that's about it I can think of.
Yeah.
And that's Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan and Jar Jar going through the planet's core. That's it. So, well, like there was a great battle.
Yes. But overall, I gave this episode a solid A.
Oh, yeah, I like it. Good start.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to pay tribute to the late, great Sean Connery. This is Geekville Radio, and we'll be right back.
Are you looking for a gaming-themed podcast? Then check out You Just Got Fragged. Join host Jared Aubrey and his panel of gaming enthusiasts as they discuss news and accomplishments in the gaming world, and, of course, the gripe of the week. That's all at YouJustGotFragged.com, part of the Wrestling Brethren podcast family.
Attention all Time Lords and ladies, Geekville Radio presents Examining the Doctor, a weekly look at everybody's favorite Time Lord, the Doctor. Join Mark and Seth as they bring their signature blend of knowledge and humor to favorite and not-so-favorite episodes of Doctor Who. From Hartnell to Capaldi, Examining the Doctor provides episode commentaries for classic and current Doctor Who fans alike. Examining the Doctor, available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at geekvilleradio.com.
Bond. James Bond.
That is, of course, the epic catchphrase, you might say, of Agent 007 James Bond, who, as many people know, was first played by Sean Connery, who passed away actually on Halloween Day this year. Nobody can say he didn't have a full life, because not too many of us reached the age of 90, but he did. And I don't know what we can say about Sean Connery that hasn't already been said, but legendary actor. I like to think, especially with James Bond, you could kind of say he was the OG of geek cred, because James Bond itself, I think, has a measure of geekery to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What was that movie that he did, the sci-fi one, and was it the 70s, where he's wearing like thigh boots and that very, very revealing outfit? That was definitely geek. Outland, was that the name of it?
That Zardoz. Outland, Zardoz, I think, yes. Was straight up sci-fi, yeah, because I remember... Right. When the pandemic hit, that one of the memes that was going around is what I thought my apocalypse outfit would be, and then what it really is.
a surgical mask.
right. And Zardoz was one of those, what it winds up being, only looks like pajamas.
One of the things I didn't realize in all the tributes that have poured out the past few days, he originally got his start as a bodybuilder. He was actually in Mr. Universe. So that's like, Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia are the top two bodybuilding contests in the world. We always knew he was a ruggedly handsome man, and the ladies loved him well into his 70s. He was at 89, he was voted sexiest man alive, and he was in his 60s then. So I didn't know. I guess seeing him in the Zardoz outfit, you can kind of see that, yeah, he was probably cut back in the day. You didn't mention playing Indiana Jones' father. That's definitely geek too, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
For me, Sean Connery, and I know not for you, but for me, Sean Connery is the greatest James Bond ever.
I think a lot of people would agree. Again, he was the original, and it's kind of hard to top the original, I think, in a lot of people's minds, because everybody that comes after that just seems to be kind of filling shoes, so to speak.
Right, and Ian Fleming was not that jazzed about his being cast originally. I think he softened over time with the success of the movies and how well accepted Connery became as the Bond character. But I think James Bond is a lot like Doctor Who. The first Doctor, the first James Bond movie you see, that's your James Bond.
Yeah.
And so obviously the James Bond of you and my youth was Roger Moore. He had taken over the role by that point. But because my father, we've talked about James Bond many times here on the podcast, my father being the big James Bond fan that he is, those were his favorites. So that was my first exposure, which is probably why he's I think Roger Moore and Sean Connery brought different things to the role. And I think the amalgam of those two are what most people see as James Bond. I think Roger Moore brought the comedy and the over the top and the real reliance on the gadgets. Sean Connery brought the suaveness, the sex appeal, the man of mystery, ladies man to the role. And you combine those two and you pretty much have what everybody thinks of when they think of James Bond.
Right. And we also can't mention his career without mentioning Highlander. That's another one that's about as geek as you can get.
Oh, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Any movie that starts with the Freebirds entering the wrestling ring, 7 out of 10. I'm sorry. Old school in their heyday Freebirds too. I always think it's funny that Vince was starting National Expand at that point, and I just don't think he was willing to give it up, but World Class was on the decline, and so they were very willing to give away to let a movie use some of their footage. Because I can't remember who the Freebirds are wrestling. I remember Brian Adias was one of them. I want to say it's Brian Adias, Chris Adams, and maybe one of the Von Erichs was the other tag team. I could be wrong, but yeah. And his role was so you got a Scotsman playing an ancient Egyptian with a Spaniard's name. Okay. All right, just checking it. Just wanted to make sure.
Complete with a Scottish accent, too.
With a Scottish accent. Well, and it has a Japanese sword, a katana. So, yeah. Can't say it wasn't diverse, right? But I think that Sean Connery is so awesome, he's one of the few guys that could have pulled that off, that insanity off.
And then he was also, I think, in the was he in the big screen remake of the Avengers as well? Not obviously not Marvel Avengers.
I don't think so, but he might have been.
And I know he was in the big screen take on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and he'd taken that because he had turned down Matrix and I think one other movie that wound up being huge hits. So that's why he did League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, because he's like he was afraid this was going to be another big hit that was going to pass him by.
Yeah, he played Alan Quartermain in that, kind of the leader of the group. And I liked that because they played up Alan Quartermain's getting older. Like, he was this great African big game hunter who early in the movie has to snipe a guy, and he pulls his long gun out and then stops to take his glasses off. So they kind of always play up the fact that he's getting old and he's losing a bit of his edge, because Sean Connery was at that point. I know he won his Oscar for Untouchables. He was great in that movie. The R-rated, you know, movie take on the old television show from the 50s that was based on the true story of Elliot Ness and Al Capone and the war that our government's law enforcement had with organized crime in your hometown of Chicago back in the 30s. So
right.
He was excellent. He won an Oscar for that. I believe that's the only Oscar he ever won. But he also did, what was that movie I was thinking of? The one he did with Wesley Snipes, I thought was excellent. It was kind of a crime drama thriller. Rising Sun, I believe it was called. That was early in Wesley's career. That was, I thought, was an excellent role for him. The thing I love about Sean was, you look back and you see Sir Sean back in the James Bond days, and he was this young, fit, good-looking guy. But he was able to accept and adapt his aging, his balding, his hair, what hair he had going gray, still retain that sex appeal with the ladies, and still come off as a badass. And I guess the one that probably showed that off more than anything else to me would be The Rock, another great movie. That's before I think Michael Bay had completely gone off the deep end. I love The Rock. Are you a fan of that movie?
Yeah, I remember it was in theaters when I was working in theaters, and just the cast of that alone, because I think Nicolas Cage was in that too, right?
Nick Cage, him. I can't think of the guy's name right now, but he was in The West Wing. Tony Todd, Ed Harris, Michael Biehn. Is anything Michael Biehn's back? Michael Biehn. Right. And shockingly, Michael Biehn plays a military guy. Wow. Shocker. But Ed Harris playing the bad guy, which he rarely does. And I think Ed Harris is a criminally underrated actor. But they never say it in that movie, but I think we're led to believe by the way the script was written is James Bond. Because if you remember, the character that Sean plays in that movie is a disavowed MI6 or MI5 agent who knows all these secrets. And we basically, as an American government, are afraid of what he knows because we screwed him. And so they've had him locked up without trial, without ever, for whatever. And he actually escaped from Alcatraz. That's how he's brought into the storyline of the movie. Is he's going to lead this assault team back into Alcatraz because he's the only one that's ever successfully escaped. And they never flat out say it, but you're led to believe he is James Bond. And I kind of liked that. They kind of dangled that carrot there without, much like in our 31 days of lesser known horror movies. I talked about the Behind the Mask, the Rise of Leslie Vernon, and how the Scott Wilson character, it's never explicitly said, but the fans in the know realize, oh, this is the killer from Black Christmas. I think the same thing was going on here with The Rock, that the fans in the know, you didn't need to believe he was James Bond to enjoy the movie, but if you did, it took it to another level. At least that's my opinion.
Right, right, exactly. And another movie that I like, again, going with the James Bond thing, I actually am really partial to Never Say Never Again, which was the time he played Bond in 83 or 84. It was his return.
Yeah, after he got a little older.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that movie is unique is that is actually not an official, quote-unquote, Bond movie. Right, it was not done by the Broccoli Estate. And when I say Broccoli, for those that don't know, Albert Broccoli was the producer of many of the Bond films until he passed.
Right, and he worked hand-in-hand with Ian Fleming while he was still alive.
Yes, yeah, and that's why when you see that movie, it doesn't have the traditional Bond theme song, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's all different music.
Which I think was what, who wrote that theme? Was that Lalo Schifrin? Same guy that did Mission Impossible theme? I think it was, wasn't it?
It might have been. And I know that Irvin Kershner directed it. And of course, we all love Irvin Kershner for Empire Strikes Back. He seems to be the king of doing sequels.
I will say this about Never Say Never Again. Has one of the best motorcycle chase scenes you'll ever see.
Definitely.
And another movie of his that I really, really enjoyed, it was one of my mother's favorites, but she was still with us, was Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Once again, you have a Scotsman who, when he stops speaking Russian, he's playing a Russian, well, actually Lithuanian, Soviet sub-commander, who once he starts speaking English, speaks with a Scottish accent. Sam Neill as his second in command, and Alec Baldwin as his interpretation of Jack Ryan. James Earl Jones, great cast, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But my mother was a big fan of Tom Clancy, the novels, and that was probably her favorite. And I think that was the first of the Jack Ryan Clancy series to be turned into a movie, wasn't it?
I believe so. That was before they cast Harrison Ford.
And then Harrison Ford, Chris Pine has played a young Jack Ryan. I can't think of the guy now from a Quiet Place that plays him on the TV show, on the Amazon series. Jack's one of those characters that had multiple. I think Ben Affleck even played him one time, didn't he?
I think he picked it up after the two movies that Harrison did. The only guy that was in the first, all three, if I recall correctly, the first three, I should say, was James Earl Jones.
Right. Played the same character, that admiral who was like a member of the Joint Chiefs or something like that.
Right.
But yeah, I love Hunt for Red October. I think it's a good movie. Once again, we talk about it when we talk about Red Dawn. You had to be alive in the 70s and 80s to understand the Cold War, to really fully grasp the fear that was there and palpable at times. Personally, my favorite, they never made it into a movie. My personal favorite Clancy novel was Cardinal of the Kremlin, which was about the Star Wars. And I don't mean the movie, the George Lucas movies, the Ronald Reagan military satellite program that was supposed to be like our ultimate defense against intercontinental ballistic missiles. Ugh, I'll get it out eventually, yeah. Folks.
Strategic Defense Initiative. I remember that name, yeah, right. SDI.
Yep. And that's what that novel's about. And it was never made into a movie. But unfortunately, the character that he played, that Connery played in Red October, was not a recurring character. He's just the antagonist who actually is a protagonist in Hunt for Red October. So we never got to see him again in any of those movies. But I thought he was outstanding in that movie. And you just believe he had a gravitas to him. You believe because of his voice and his natural charisma, Sean Connery. Because to understand the story of Hunt for Red October, sorry for spoiling a movie almost 30 years old for those who haven't seen it, you have to believe the character that he plays essentially gets all of his junior officers on this experimental Soviet sub to agree they're going to defect to America and do it in a way that the Soviets don't get their submarine back and they give it to the Americans. That right. takes a lot of faith of a lot of very intelligent men with a lot at risk. And you just believe because Sean Connery and his ability. Oh, yeah. I'd go to war with this guy. I would believe what he said. I think in the hands of a lesser actor, that character would have been harder to pull off because of that element.
Right. And like you said, it's the type of story that wouldn't make much sense now. But
right.
in the early 90s or the late 80s, it totally made sense because the threat of the Soviet Union / Russia was very real. I mean, whether it was manufactured or not, the fear was real.
Yes, and it still has one of my favorite lines ever in a movie where the guy who's on the cabinet member talks to Jack Ryan, and Jack's questioning him, and he goes, look, I'm a politician, which means when I ain't kissing babies, I'm stealing their lollipops, which I still think is one of the greatest lines ever. But anyway.
For some reason, the conversation that sticks the most in my mind was when he and Sam Neill's character were talking about living in America, and it's just like, so where do we go? Where can we go? Well, I think they let you live where you want. No papers?
No papers, yeah. People forget, Soviet Socialist Republic. It was a collection of states, and you had, unlike the states here, yeah, you had to have papers to go from state to state there. Mm-hmm. I do, another one you need to mention that was also, you know, had a small role in that movie, the wonderful, no longer with us, Fred Thompson. Former, you know, senator from Tennessee and presidential hopeful, probably most well known as the DA for years on Law and Order SVU, but he plays captain of an American ship. Scott Glenn was great as the American sub captain. That movie's just loaded with really, really good character actors that you and me have talked about before. I think are just dying. It's a dying breed in Hollywood. They don't have great character actors. You got all these great character actors, this solid script, and then, oh, by the way, you've got A-listers like Alec Baldwin and Sean Connery leading your cast. How can you not like that movie?
Right. Are there any other Sean Connery recommendations? Because I think there's a lot of people, a lot of our listeners are probably going to go on a Sean Connery binge if they haven't already.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we've hit all the big ones for geek stuff. Any of the James Bond. And he did, what, the first five? Plus, did he, like you said, again, the 80s, he did Never Say Never Again. The Rock, Zardoz, Outland.
He only has a cameo in it, but if you like the offbeat, eccentric humor, there was Time Bandits from 1981.
Yes. Well, and he did have a cameo, of course, at the end of the Kevin Costner Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which... that's Morgan Freeman, so that's worth watching again, too. He doesn't right. show up to the very end, but he plays King Richard. And then, of course, when the parody of that movie was made, the Cary Elwes Robin Hood Men in Tights, Mel Brooks, the Patrick Stewart plays the same role. Like, you get two guys who've been knighted to play King Richard. Okay, I'm down with that.
And then there were two in the mid-90s, because I remember he was in First Knight, and that movie's okay. So it's not great, but he played King Arthur, which is a perfect role for him. But then the following year... he was in Dragonheart as the voice of the dragon, which also mentions King Arthur. So it's
right.
like,
and that's Randy Quaid, right? Randy or Dennis was in that one.
It was Dennis Quaid was the main character yeah. in that.
The non-crazy Quaid brother. Yeah, I had forgotten he had done the voice in that. And that was one of those movies that just kind of flew under the radar. And if you're a geek who's into fantasy, that's, I think, actually a really good movie, you know?
Yeah. You could make the argument that it was, I don't know if one of the first, but it was, certainly a fantasy movie that looked believable, because for so many years,
yes.
fantasy movies, you could tell that the characters were just walking in front of a painting, you know, right. when they're doing right. their stuff. Yeah.
And that's no disrespect to the legendary and iconic Ray Harryhausen, but the effects had caught up and it wasn't just stop motion anymore. But I had totally forgotten about that movie. I would say in many ways, it was Aragon long before Aragon, and it probably was better than Aragon, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree.
He had such diversity. I know for a long time, he was one of those, because he was a proud Scotsman, who even had tattooed on his wrist, Scotland Forever, or something like that. He was one of those actors that for a long time, everybody's like, why has he not been knighted yet? Why has he not been knighted yet? I know for years it was a political thing, because he was so vocal publicly about Scotland being free from England. And finally, the queen capitulated. I can't remember when it was, but she did knight him. It is what it is. I don't think it downplays anything if he had never gotten knighted. He'd still have been Sean Connery. But it was nice that he got that before he died. So, yeah, I think he's just an extremely diverse actor. The thing that always impresses me, like I said, is here's a guy who was obviously good-looking and great body and aged so gracefully and seemed to become even have more sex appeal the older he got. And that is a hard thing to pull off, ladies and gentlemen. And he did it. He did it well.
Mm-hmm. That puts him in the league of people like, you know, Harrison Ford. I think Harrison Ford has that quality. Yeah.
Denzel Washington has it. The older Denzel gets, the better looking he gets.
Yeah. The aforementioned Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott. I hate these guys, man. But it is what it is. And I 90 years, you cannot say he didn't. He didn't live a full life. 90 years is a good long life for anybody. I'm just glad I got to be around to see him do his thing, because he will always be James Bond to me. Always.
Yeah, agreed.
Every little bit of what we think of with James Bond, with his coolness, that comes from Sean Connery. Vodka martini, shaken, not stirred, lighting his cigarettes with his Ronson lighter. Bond, James Bond. That's all Sean. That's mm-hmm. all Sean.
Epic manliness, I guess, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Yet another thing, too, which is amazing. And I want to mention this before we go. He had that quote in an interview he did back in the 60s that came back to bite him in the 80s and was able to avoid the cancel culture of today, shockingly, where he openly said in the 60s that sometimes you have to smack a woman. That was his words, not mine, ladies and gentlemen. And then when he had an interview with Barbara Walters in the 80s, she questioned him about it. And he didn't back away from it. He said, look, I don't want to do it, and I don't go out doing it. I think it needs to be a particular set of circumstances. But, yeah, if those circumstances are present, there's nothing wrong with smacking a woman. And he never backed down from that. And I think it's a statement to how beloved he is that in today's age. That made the rounds again a few years ago, and it still didn't get him canceled. How many other actors can you think of that would have said such a controversial thing that wouldn't have gotten destroyed in today's social climate? And he didn't. It came back again. And, ask Sean Connery. I mean, so it's like, wow. He's almost bulletproof.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of Geekville Radio. You can find us at geekvilleradio.com, social media at Geekville Radio on Twitter and Facebook. You can contact us through the social media. You can also post on the geekvilleradio.com page on any of the articles or podcasts that we have. And we can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, pretty much you name it, wherever podcasts can be found. And Train, if people want to talk to you about Sean Connery or Mandalorian or wrestling or whatever, where can they find you?
I'm always available on Twitter at crazytrain_JB. Also, I'm, like I've said before, I'm an administrator on the Examine the Dead podcast. Of course, that's our horror-centric, and I host that podcast. But that's another way you can reach me if you don't have a Twitter account.
All right, we're going to wrap it up here. We're going to shut off the power here in the Geekville Radio studios, and we'll talk to you folks again next time.
Geekville Radio is not sponsored or endorsed by any products or services unless specifically stated. The views expressed by the hosts and or guests do not reflect the views of GeekvilleRadio.com, the Wrestling Brethren podcast, family, or any of their affiliates. Some media used in Geekville Radio is the product of their respective copyright holders, all rights reserved.
I am the last one. You win, you'll be out of work.